with pity on the soul of our dear one in purgatory. O you who loved your own, hear my cry for mercy. In 10 more minutes, announced Francie, it will be 1917. Francie and her brother were sitting side by side with their stockinged feet inside the oven of the kitchen range. Mama, who had given strict orders to be called 5 minutes before midnight, was resting on her bed. I have a feeling, continued Francie, that 1917 will be more important than any year we've ever had. You say that about every year, claimed Neely. First 1915 was going to be the most important, then 1916, and now 1917. It will be important. For one thing, in 1917 I'll be 16 for real instead of just in the office. And other important things have started already. The landlord's putting in wires. In a few weeks we'll have electricity instead of gas. Suits me. Then he's going to rip out these stoves and put in steam heat. Gee, I'll miss this old stove. Remember how in olden times, 2 years ago, I used to sit on the stove? And I used to be afraid you'd catch on fire. I feel like sitting on the stove right now. Go ahead. He sat on the surface furthest away from the firebox. It was pleasantly warm, but not hot. Remember, Francie went on, how we did our examples on this hearthstone, and the time Papa got us a real blackboard eraser, and then the stone was like the blackboard in school, only lying down? Yeah. That was a long time ago. But look, you can't claim 1917 is going to be important because we'll have electricity and steam heat. Other flats have had them for years. That's nothing important. The important thing about this year is that we'll get into the war. When? Soon. Next week. Next month. How do you know? I read the papers every day, brother. 200 of them. Oh, boy. I hope it lasts till I'm old enough to join the Navy. Who's joining the Navy? They looked around, startled. Mama was standing in the bedroom doorway. We're just talking, Mama, explained Francie. You forgot to call me, said Mama reproachfully, and I thought I heard a whistle. It must be New Year's now. Francie threw open the window. It was a frosty night without a wind. All was still. Across the yards, the backs of the houses were dark and brooding. As they stood at the window, they heard the joyous peal of a church bell. Then other bell sounds tumbled over the first pealing. Whistles came in. A siren shrieked. Darkened windows banged open. Tin horns were added to the cacophony. Someone fired off a blank cartridge. There were shouts and catcalls. 1917! The sounds died away, and the air was filled with waiting. Someone started to sing. Should old acquaintance be forgot and never brought to mind? The Nolans picked up the song. One by one, the neighbors joined in, and they all sang. But as they sang, something disquieting came among them. A group of Germans were singing around. The German words crowded into Auld Lang Syne. Ja, das ist ein Gartenhaus, Gartenhaus, Gartenhaus. Ach, du schönes, ach, du schönes, ach, du schönes Gartenhaus. Someone shouted, Shut up, you lousy heinies! In answer, the German song swelled mightily and drowned out Auld Lang Syne. In retaliation, the Irish shouted a parody of the song across the dark backyards. Yeah, das ist a goddamn song, goddamn song, goddamn song. O du lousy, oh du lousy, heiny song. Windows could be heard shutting as the Jews and Italians withdrew, leaving the fight to the Germans and Irish. The Germans sang lustier and more voices came in until they killed the parody, even as they had killed Auld Lang Syne. The Germans won. They finished their interminable rounds in shouting triumph. Francie shivered. I don't like Germans, she said. They're so persistent when they want something, and they've always got to be ahead. Once more the night was quiet. Francie grabbed her mother and Neely. All together now, she ordered. The three of them leaned out of the window and shouted, Happy New Year, everybody! An instant of silence, then out of the dark a thick Irish brogue shouted, Happy New Year, yous Nolans! Now who could that be? Puzzled Katie. Happy New Year, you dirty Irish Mick! Neely screamed back. Mama clapped her hand over his mouth and pulled him away, while Francie slammed the window down. All three of them were laughing hysterically. Now you did it, gasped Francie, laughing so hard that she cried. He knows who we are, and he'll come around here and fight, gurgled Katie, so weak from laughing that she had to hold on to the table. Who was it? Old man O'Brien. Last week he cursed me out of his yard, the dirty Irish. Hush, said Mama. You know that whatever you do when the new year starts, you'll do all year. And you don't want to go around saying dirty Irish Mick like a busted record, do you? Asked Francie. Besides, you're a Mick yourself. You too, accused Neely. We're all Irish, except Mama. And I'm Irish by marriage, she said. Well, do us Irish drink a toast on New Year's Eve, or don't we? Demanded Francie. Of course, said Mama. I'll mix us a drink. McGarity had given the Nolans a bottle of fine old brandy for Christmas. Now Katie poured a small jiggerful of it into each of three tall glasses. She filled the rest of each glass with beaten egg and milk, mixed with a little sugar. She grated nutmeg and sprinkled it on the top. Her hands were steady as she worked, although she considered this drinking tonight as something crucial. She worried constantly that the children might have inherited the Nolan love of drink. She had tried to come to an attitude about liquor in the family. She felt that if she preached against it, the children, unpredictable individualists that they were, might consider drinking forbidden and fascinating. On the other hand, if she made light of it, they might consider drunkenness a natural thing. She decided neither to make nothing of it nor much of it, to proceed as though drinking was no more or less than something to be moderately indulged in at seasonal times. Well, New Year's was such a time. She handed each a glass. A lot depended on their reactions. "What do we drink to?" asked Francie. "To a hope," said Katie. "A hope that our family will always be together the way it is tonight." "Wait," said Francie. "Get Laurie, so she's together with us, too." Katie got the patient sleeping baby out of her crib and carried her into the warm kitchen. Laurie opened her eyes, lifted her head, and showed two teeth in a befuddled smile. Then her head went down on Katie's shoulder, and she was asleep again. "Now," said Francie, holding up her glass, "to being together, always." They clicked glasses and drank. Neely tasted his drink, frowned, and said he'd rather have plain milk. He poured the drink down the sink and filled another glass with cold milk. Katie watched, worried, as Francie drained her glass. "It's good," Francie said. "Pretty good, but not half as good as a vanilla ice cream soda." "What am I worrying about?" sang Katie inwardly. "After all, they're as much Romilly as Nolan, and we Romillys are not drinking people." "Neely, let's go up on the roof," said Francie impulsively, "and see how the whole world looks at the beginning of a year." "Okay," he agreed. "Put your shoes on first," ordered Mama, "and your coats." They climbed the shaky wooden ladder. Neely pushed the opening aside, and they were on the roof. The night was heady and frosty. There was no wind, and the air was cold and still. The stars were brilliant and hung low in the sky. There were so many stars that their light made the sky a deep cobalt blue. There wasn't a moon, but the starlight served better than moonlight. Francie stood on tiptoe and stretched her arms wide. "Oh, I want to hold it all," she cried. "I want to hold the way the night is, cold without wind, and the way the stars are so near and shiny. I want to hold all of it tight until it hollers out, 'Let me go, let me go.'" "Don't stand so near the edge," said Neely uneasily. "You might fall off the roof." "I need someone," thought Francie desperately. "I need someone. I need to hold somebody close. And I need more than this holding. I need someone to understand how I feel at a time like now. And the understanding must be part of the holding. I love Mama and Neely and Laurie, but I need someone to love in a different way from the way I love them." If I talked to Mama about it, she'd say, "Yes? Well, when you get that feeling, don't linger in dark hallways with the boys." She'd worry, too, thinking I was going to be the way Sissy used to be. But it isn't an Aunt Sissy thing, because there's this understanding that I want almost more than I want the holding. If I told Sissy or Evie, they'd talk the same as Mama, although Sissy was married at 14 and Evie at 16. Mama was only a girl when she married. But they've forgotten, and they tell me I was too young to be having such ideas. I'm young, maybe, and just being 15, but I'm older than those years in some things. But there is no one for me to hold, and no one to understand. Maybe someday. Someday. Neely, if you had to die, wouldn't it be wonderful to die now? While you believe that everything was perfect, the way this night is perfect. You know what?
Asked Neely.
No, what? You're drunk from that milk punch. That's what. She clenched her hands and advanced on him. Don't you say that! Don't you ever say that!
He backed away, frightened at her fierceness.
That's all right, he stammered. I was drunk myself once.
She lost her anger and curiosity.
Were you, Neely? Honest?
Yeah.
One of the fellas had some bottles of beer, and we went down the cellar and drank it. I drank two bottles and got drunk.
What did it feel like?
Well, first, the whole world turned upside down. Then everything was like, you know those cardboard toots you buy for a penny, and you look in the small end and turn the big end, and pieces of colored paper keep falling around and they never fall around the same way twice? Mostly, though, I was very dizzy. Afterwards, I vomited.
Then I've been drunk, too, admitted Francie.
On beer? No. Last spring, in McCarran's Park, I saw a tulip for the first time in my life.
How'd you know it was a tulip if you'd never seen one?
I'd seen pictures. Well, when I looked at it, the way it was growing and how the leaves were and how purely red the petals were, with yellow inside, the world turned upside down and everything went around like the colors in a kaleidoscope, like you said. I was so dizzy I had to sit on a park bench.
Did you throw up too?
No, she answered, and I've got that same feeling here on this roof tonight, and I know it's not the milk punch.
Gee,
she remembered something. Mama tested us when she gave us that milk punch. I know it.
Poor Mama, said Neely.
But she doesn't have to worry about me. I'll never get drunk again, because I don't like to throw up. And she doesn't have to worry about me either. I don't need to drink to get drunk. I can get drunk on things like the tulip. And this night.
I guess it is a swell night, agreed Neely.
It's so still and bright. Almost holy.
She waited, if Papa were here with her now.
Neely sang.
Silent night, holy night, all is calm, all is bright.
He's just like Papa, she thought happily. She looked out over Brooklyn, the starlight half revealed, half concealed. She looked out over the flat roofs, uneven in height, broken once in a while by a slanting roof from a house left over from older times, the chimney pots on the roofs, and on some, the shadowing looming of pigeon cotes, sometimes, faintly heard, the sleepy cooing of pigeons, the twin spires of the church remotely brooding over the dark tenements, and at the end of their street, the great bridge that threw itself like a sigh across the East River and was lost, lost, on the other shore. The dark East River beneath the bridge, and far away, the misty gray skyline of New York, looking like a city cut from cardboard.
There's no other place like it, Francie said.
Like what?
Brooklyn.
It's a magic city, and it isn't real.
It's just like any other place.
It isn't. I go to New York every day, and New York's not the same. I went to Bayonne once to see a girl from the office who was homesick, and Bayonne isn't the same. It's mysterious here in Brooklyn. It's like, yes, like a dream. The houses and streets don't seem real. Neither do the people. They're real enough, the way they fight and holler at each other, and the way they're poor, and dirty too. But it's like a dream of being poor and fighting. They don't really feel these things. It's like it's all happening in a dream.
Brooklyn is no different than any other place, said Neely firmly. It's only your imagination makes it different.
But that's all right, he added magnanimously, as long as it makes you feel so happy.
Neely, so much like Mama, so much like Papa, the best of each in Neely. She loved her brother. She wanted to put her arms around him and kiss him, but he was like Mama. He hated people to be demonstrative. If she tried to kiss him, he'd get mad and push her away. So she held out her hand instead.
Happy New Year, Neely.
The same to you.
They shook hands solemnly.
For the little while of the Christmas holidays, it had been almost like old times in the Nolan family. But after New Year's, things reverted to the new routine which had grown on them since Johnny's death. There were no more piano lessons, for one thing. Francie hadn't practiced in months. Neely did his piano playing evenings in the neighborhood ice cream saloons. He had been expert at ragtime and was becoming even more expert at jazz. He could make a piano talk, so people said, and he was very popular. He played for free sodas. Sometimes Sheafley gave him a dollar on a Saturday night for playing the whole evening. Francie didn't like it and spoke to her mother about it. "I wouldn't let him, Mama," she said. "But where's the harm in it? You don't want him to get into the habit of playing for free refreshments like..." She hesitated. Katie picked up the sentence. "Like your father?" "No, he'd never be like him. Your father never sang the songs he loved, like Annie Laurie or The Last Rose of Summer. He sang what the people wanted, Sweet Adeline and Down by the Old Mill Stream. Neely's different. He'll always play what he likes and not care 2 cents whether anyone else likes it." "You're saying, then, that Papa was only an entertainer and that Neely is an artist?" "Well, yes," admitted Katie defiantly. "I think that's carrying mother love a little too far." Katie frowned, and Francie dropped the subject. They had stopped reading the Bible and Shakespeare since Neely started high school. He reported that they were studying Julius Caesar, and the principal read from the Bible each assembly period, and that was enough for Neely. Francie begged off reading at night because her eyes were tired from reading all day. Katie did not insist, feeling that they were now old enough to read or not, just as they wished. Francie's evenings were lonely. The Nolans were together only at the supper hour, when even Laurie sat up to the table in her high chair. After supper, Neely went out, either to be with his gang or to play at some ice cream saloon. Mama read the paper, and then she and Laurie went to bed at 8 o'clock. Katie was still getting up at 5 in order to have most of her cleaning done, while Francie and Neely were in the flat with the baby. Francie seldom went to the movies, because they jumped around so and hurt her eyes. There were no shows to go to. Most of the stock companies had gone out of existence. Besides, she had seen Barrymore in Galsworthy's Justice on Broadway, and she was spoiled for stock companies after that. That past fall she had seen a movie she liked, War Brides with Nazimova. She had hoped to see it again, but read in the papers that because of the imminence of war, the film had been banned. She had a wonderful memory of journeying to a strange part of Brooklyn to see the great Sarah Bernhardt in a one-act play in a Keith Vaudeville house. The great actress was past 70, but looked half that age from the stage. Francie couldn't understand the French, but she gathered that the play was written around the actress's amputated leg. Bernhardt played the part of a French soldier who had lost his leg in the war. Francie caught the word Boche from time to time. Francie would never forget the flaming red hair and the golden voice of Bernhardt. She treasured the program in her scrapbook. But those had been just 3 evenings out of months and months of evenings. Spring came early that year, and the sweet, warm nights made her restless. She walked up and down the streets and through the park. And wherever she went, she saw a boy and a girl together, walking arm in arm, sitting on a park bench with their arms around each other, standing closely and in silence in a vestibule. Everyone in the world but Francie had a sweetheart or a friend. She seemed to be the only lonely one in Brooklyn. March 1917. All the neighborhood could think or talk about was the inevitability of war. A widow living in the flats had an only son. She was afraid he'd have to go and would be killed. She bought him a cornet and made him take lessons, figuring he'd be put in an army band and play at parades and reviews only and be kept away from the front. People in the house were tormented almost to death by his incessant fumbling cornet practice. One harassed man, made crafty by desperation, told the mother that he had inside information that the military bands led the soldiers into action and invariably were the first ones killed. The terrified mother pawned the cornet immediately and destroyed the pawn ticket. There was no more dreadful practicing. Each night at supper, Katie asked Francie, "Has the war started yet?" "Not yet, but any day now." "Well, I wish it would hurry up and start." "Do you want war?" "No, I don't. But if it has to be, the sooner the better. The sooner it starts, the quicker it will end." Then Sissy created such a sensation that the war was pushed into the background temporarily. Sissy, who is done with her wild past and who should have been settling down into the calm that precedes satisfied middle age, threw the family into a turmoil by falling madly in love with the John to whom she had been married for more than 5 years. Not only that, but she got herself widowed, divorced, married, and pregnant, all in 10 days' time. The Standard Union, Williamsburg's favorite newspaper, was delivered as usual one afternoon to Francie's desk at closing time. As usual, she took it home so that Katie could read it after supper. Francie would bring it back to the office the next morning and read and mark it. Since Francie never read newspapers outside of office hours, she had no way of knowing what was in that particular issue. After supper, Katie sat by the window to look through the paper. An instant after turning the third page, she exploded her, "Oh, my!" of utter astonishment. Francie and Neely ran to look over her shoulder. Katie pointed to a heading. Hero fireman loses life in wallabout market blaze. Underneath, in small type, was a subheading. Had planned to retire on pension next month. Reading the item, Francie discovered that the heroic fireman had been Sissy's first husband. There was a picture of Sissy taken 20 years ago. Sissy with a towering crimped pompadour and huge leg of mutton sleeves. Sissy 16 years old. There was a caption under Sissy's picture. Widow of heroic firefighter. "Oh, my," repeated Katie. "Then he never married again. He must have kept Sissy's picture all that time, and when he died some men must have gone through his stuff and found Sissy." "I've got to go over there right away." Katie took off her apron and went to get her hat, explaining. "Sissy's John reads the papers. She told him she was divorced. Now that he knows the truth, he'll kill her. At least throw her out," she amended. "She'll have no place to go with the baby and mother." "He seems like a nice man," said Francie. "I don't think he'd do that." "We don't know what all he won't do. We don't know anything about him. He's a stranger in the family and always has been. Pray God I don't get there too late." Francie insisted on going along, and Neely agreed to stay home with the baby on condition that he be told every single thing that happened. When they got to Sissy's house, they found her rosy with excitement. Grandma Mary Romilly had taken the baby and retired to the front room, where she sat in the dark and prayed for everything to come out all right. Sissy's John gave them his version of the story. "I'm away working in the shop, see? These here men come to the house and say to Sissy, 'Your husband's just been killed, see? Sissy thinks they mean me.'" He turned on Sissy suddenly. "Did you cry?" "You could hear me on the next block," she assured him. He seemed gratified. "They asked Sissy what they should do with the body. Sissy asks, 'Is there any insurance, see?' Well, it turns out there is, for $500, paid up 10 years ago and still made out in Sissy's name. So what does Sissy go to work and do? She tells them to lay him out in Speck's funeral parlor, see? A $500 funeral, she orders." "I had to make the arrangements," apologized Sissy. "I'm his only living relation." "And that's not all," he went on. "Now they're going to come around and give Sissy a pension. I won't stand for it," he roared suddenly. "When I marry her," he went on more calmly, "she tells me she's a divorced woman. Now it turns out she's not." "But there's no divorce in the Catholic Church," insisted Sissy. "You wasn't married in the Catholic Church." "I know, so I never considered I was married and didn't think I had to get a divorce." He threw his hands up in the air and moaned, "I give up." It was the same cry of futile despair he had uttered when Sissy had insisted that she had given birth to the baby. "I marry her in good faith, see? And what does she do?" he asked rhetorically. "She turns right around and makes us live in adultery."
"Don't say that," said Sissy sharply. "We're not living in adultery. We're living in bigamy. And it's got to stop right now, see? You're widowed from the first one, and you're going to get a divorce from the second, and then you're going to marry me again, see?"
"Yes, John," she said meekly.
"And my name ain't John," he roared. "It's Steve, Steve, Steve."
With each repetition of his name, he pounded on the table so hard that the blue glass sugar bowl with the spoons hanging around its rim clattered up and down. He pushed a finger into Francie's face.
"And you, from now on, I'm Uncle Steve, see?"
Francie stared at the transformed man in dumb amazement.
"Well, what do you say?" he barked.
Hello, Uncle Steve."
"That's more like it."
He was mollified. He took his hat from a nail behind the door and jammed it on his head.
"Where are you going, John? I mean, Steve?"
asked Katie, worried. Listen, when I was a kid, my old man always went out and got ice cream when company came in his house. Well, this is my house, see? And I got company. So I'm going out and get a quart of strawberry ice cream, see?
He went.
Isn't he wonderful? Sighed Sissy. A woman could fall in love with a person like that.
Looks like the Romilly's have a man in the family at last, commented Katie dryly. Francie went into the dark front room. By the light of the street lamp, she saw her grandmother sitting at the window, with Sissy's sleeping baby in her lap, and amber rosary beads dangling from her trembling fingers.
You can stop praying now, Grandma, she said. Everything's all right. He went out for ice cream, see?
Glory be to the Father, and to the Son, and to the Holy Ghost, praised Mary Romilly.
In Sissy's name, Steve wrote to her second husband at his last known address and put "Please forward" on the envelope. Sissy asked him to consent to a divorce so that she might remarry. A week later, a fat letter came from Wisconsin. Sissy's second husband informed her that he was well, had obtained a Wisconsin divorce 7 years ago, had promptly remarried, settled down in Wisconsin where he had a good job, and was the father of 3 children. He was very happy, he wrote, and in belligerently underlined words threatened that he intended to stay that way. He enclosed an old press clipping to prove that she had been legally informed of the divorce action by publication. He enclosed a photostatic copy of the decree, grounds, desertion, and a snapshot of 3 bouncing children. Sissy was so happy at being divorced so quickly that she sent him a silver-plated pickle dish as a belated wedding present. She felt that she had to send a letter of congratulation also. Steve refused to write it for her, so she asked Francie to do it.
"Write that I hope he'll be very happy," dictated Sissy.
"But Aunt Sissy, he's been married 7 years, and it's settled by now, whether he's happy or not."
"When you first hear that someone's married, it's polite to wish them happiness. Write it down."
"All right," she wrote it down. "What else?" "Write something about his children. How cute they are. Something like..."
The word stuck in her throat. She knew he had sent the picture to prove that Sissy's stillborn children had not been his fault. That hurt Sissy.
"Write that I'm the mother of a beautiful, healthy baby girl and put a line under healthy.
But Steve's letter said you were only planning to get married. This man might think it funny that you got a baby so soon."
"Write it like I said," ordered Sissy. "And write that I expect another baby to be born next week."
"Sissy, you don't, really."
"Of course not, but write it down anyhow." Francie wrote that down. "Anything else?"
"Say thanks for the divorce paper."
"Then say I got my own divorce a year before he got it."
"Only I forgot,"
she concluded lamely.
"But that's a lie."
"I did get the divorce before he did. I got it in my mind."
All right," surrendered Francie. "Write that I'm very happy and intend to stay that way and put a line under those words like he did."
"Gosh, Sissy, must you have the last word?"
"Yes, just like your mother has to have it, and Evie, and you too."
Francie made no more objections. Steve got a license and married Sissy all over again. This time a Methodist minister performed the ceremony. It was Sissy's first marriage by the church, and at last she believed that she was truly married until death did the parting. Steve was very happy. He loved Sissy and had always been afraid of losing her. She had left her other husbands casually and with no regrets. He had been afraid that she'd leave him too, and take with her the baby whom he had grown to love dearly. He knew that Sissy believed in the church, any church, Catholic or Protestant, that she'd never walk out on a church marriage. For the first time in their relationship, he felt happy, secure, and masterful. And Sissy discovered that she was madly in love with him. Sissy came over one evening after Katie had gone to bed. She told her not to get up, that she'd sit in the bedroom and talk to her. Francie was sitting at the kitchen table pasting poems in old notebooks. She kept a razor blade at the office and cut out poems and stories she liked for her scrapbooks. She had a series of them. One was labeled "The Nolan Book of Classical Poems." Another, "The Nolan Volume of Contemporary Poetry." A third was "The Book of Annie Laurie," in which Francie was collecting nursery rhymes and animal stories to be read to Laurie when she was old enough to understand. The voices coming from the dark bedroom made a soothing rhythm. Francie listened as she pasted. Sissy was saying, "Steve, so fine and decent." And when I realized it, I hated myself on account of the others. Outside of my husband's, I mean.
"You didn't tell him about the others?" asked Katie apprehensively.
"Do I look like a fool? But I wish with all my heart that he had been the first and only one."
"Woman talks that way," said Katie. "It means she's going into the change of life."
"How do you make that out?"
"If she never had any lovers, she kicks herself around when the change comes, thinking of all the fun she could have had, didn't have, and now can't have. If she had a lot of lovers, she argues herself into believing that she did wrong, and she's sorry now. She carries on that way because she knows that soon all her womanness will be lost.
Lost.
And if she makes believe being with a man was never any good in the first place, she can get comfort out of her change."
"I'm not going into any change of life," said Sissy indignantly. "In the first place, I'm too young. And in the second place, I wouldn't stand for it."
"It has to come to all of us someday," sighed Katie. There was terror in Sissy's voice.
"Not to be able to have children anymore? To be half a woman? Get fat? Have hair grow on your chin? I'll kill myself first," she cried passionately.
"Anyhow," she added complacently, "I'm nowhere near the change, because I'm that way again." There was a rustle from the dark bedroom. Francie could visualize her mother raising herself on her elbow.
"No, Sissy, no. You can't go through that again. 10 times this happened. 10 children stillborn. And it will be harder this time, because you're going for 37.
"That's not too old to have a baby."
"No, but it's too old to get over another disappointment easily."
"You needn't worry, Katie. This child will live."
"You've said that each time."
"This time I'm sure, because I feel that God is on my side," she said with quiet assurance. After a while she said, "I told Steve how I got little Sissy."
"What did he say?"
"He knew all the while I hadn't given birth to her, but the way I claimed I had got him mixed up. He said it didn't matter as long as I didn't have her by another man, and that since we had her from birth almost, he really feels that she's his baby. It's funny how the baby looks like him. She has his dark eyes, and the same round chin, and the same small ears close to her head like him."
"She got those dark eyes from Lucia, and a million people in the world have round chins and small ears. But if it makes Steve happy to think the baby looks like him, that's fine."
There was a long silence before Katie spoke again.
"Sissy, did you ever get any idea from that Italian family as to who the father was?"
"No."
Sissy, too, waited a long time before she continued.
"You know who told me about the girl being in trouble and where she lived and all?"
"Who?"
"Steve." "Oh, my."
Both were quiet for a long time. Then Katie said,
"Of course, that was accidental."
"Of course," agreed Sissy.
"One of the fellows in his shop told him, he said. A fellow who lived on Lucia's block."
"Of course," Katie repeated.
"You know, funny things happen here in Brooklyn that have no meaning at all. Like sometimes I'm walking on the street, and I think of someone I haven't seen maybe in 5 years, and I turn a corner, and there's that person walking towards me."
"I know," answered Sissy.
"Sometimes I'm doing something that I never did before in my life, and all of a sudden I have the feeling that I did that same thing before, maybe in another life."
Her voice died away. After a while she said,
"Steve always said he'd never take another man's child."
"All men say that. Life's funny," Katie went on. "A couple of accidental things come together, and a person could make a lot out of them. It was just an accident that you got to know about that girl. That same fellow must have told 12 men in the shop. Steve just mentioned it to you accidentally. It was just by accident that you got in with that family, and just accidental that the baby has a round instead of a square chin. It's even less than accidental, it's..." Katie stopped her search for a word. Francie in the kitchen had become so interested that she forgot that she wasn't supposed to be listening. When she knew her mother was groping for a word, she supplied it unthinkingly.
"You mean coincidental, Mama?"
she called out. A shocked silence came from the bedroom. Then the conversation was resumed, but this time in whispers. A newspaper lay on Francie's desk. It was an extra and had come directly from the presses. The ink was still damp on its headline. The paper had been there 5 minutes, and as yet she had not picked up her pencil to mark it. She stared at the date. April 6th, 1917. The one-word headline was 6 inches high. The three letters were smudged at the edges, and the word war seemed to waver. Francie had a vision. 50 years from now, she'd be telling her grandchildren how she had come to the office, sat at her reader's desk, and in the routine of work had read that war had been declared. She knew from listening to her grandmother that old age was made up of such remembrances of youth. But she didn't want to recall things. She wanted to live things. Or as a compromise, relive rather than reminisce. She decided to fix this time in her life exactly the way it was this instant. Perhaps that way she could hold on to it as a living thing and not have it become something called a memory. She brought her eyes close to the surface of her desk and examined the patterned grain of the wood. She ran her fingers along the groove where her pencils rested, fixing the feel of the groove in her mind. Using a razor blade, she nicked the next dot on one of her pencils and unraveled the paper. She held the raveling in her palm, touched it with her forefinger, and noted it spiraling. She dropped it into the metal wastebasket, counting the seconds it took to fall. She listened intently so as not to miss its almost noiseless thud as it hit the bottom. She pressed her fingertips to the damp headline, examined her inked fingertips, then made fingerprints on a sheet of white paper. Not caring about clients who might be mentioned on pages 1 and 2, she detached the front sheet of the newspaper and folded the sheet into a careful oblong, watching the creases come under her thumb. She inserted it into one of the strong manila envelopes that the bureau used to mail clippings in. Francie heard, as if for the first time, the sound the desk drawer made when she opened it to get her purse. She noted the device of the purse's catch, the sound of its click. She felt the leather, memorized its smell, and studied the whorlings of the black moiré silk lining. She read the dates on the coins in her change purse. There was a new 1917 penny, which she put in the envelope. She uncapped her lipstick and made a line with it under her fingerprints. The clear red color, the texture and the scent of it pleased her. She examined, in turn, the powder in her compact, the ridges on her nail file, the way her comb was inflexible, and the threads of her handkerchief. There was a worn clipping in the purse, a poem she had torn out of an Oklahoma newspaper. It had been written by a poet who had lived in Brooklyn, gone to the Brooklyn Public Schools, and as a young man had edited the Brooklyn Eagle. She reread it for the 20th time, handling each word in her mind. "I am of old and young, of the foolish as much as the wise. Regardless of others, ever regardful of others. Maternal as well as paternal, a child as well as a man. Stuffed with the stuff that is coarse, and stuffed with the stuff that is fine." The tattered poem went into the envelope. In the mirror of her compact, she looked at the way her hair was braided, how the braids wound around her head. She noticed how her straight black eyelashes were uneven in length. Then her shoes were inspected. She ran her hand down her stockings and for the first time noticed that the silk felt rough instead of smooth. The fabric of her dress was made of tiny cords. She turned back the hem and noticed that the narrow lace edge of her slip was diamond-shaped in design. "If I can fix every detail of this time in my mind, I can keep this moment always," she thought. Using the razor blade, she clipped a lock of her hair, wrapped it in the square of paper on which were her fingerprints and lipstick mark, folded it, placed it in the envelope, and sealed the envelope. On the outside, she wrote, "Francis Nolan, age 15 years and 4 months, April 6, 1917. She thought, "If I open this envelope 50 years from now, I will be again as I am now, and there will be no being old for me. There's a long, long time yet before 50 years, millions of hours of time.
But 1 hour has gone already since I sat here. 1 hour less to live. 1 hour gone away from all the hours of my life. Dear God, she prayed, let me be something every minute of every hour of my life. Let me be gay. Let me be sad. Let me be cold. Let me be warm. Let me be hungry, have too much to eat. Let me be ragged or well-dressed. Let me be sincere, be deceitful. Let me be truthful. Let me be a liar. Let me be honorable and let me sin. Only let me be something every blessed minute. And when I sleep, let me dream all the time so that not one little piece of living is ever lost.
The delivery boy came by and slapped another city paper on her desk. This one had a two-word headline. War declared. The floor seemed to swerve up. Colors flashed before her eyes, and she put her head down on the ink-damp paper and wept quietly. One of the older readers, returning from the washroom, paused by Francie's desk. She noticed the headline and the weeping girl. She thought she understood.
"Ah, the war," she sighed. "You have a sweetheart or a brother, I presume?"
she asked in her stilted, readerish way.
"Yes, I have a brother," Francie answered truthfully enough.
"My sympathies, Miss Nolan,"
the reader went back to her desk.
"I'm drunk again," thought Francie, "and this time on a newspaper headline. And this is a bad one. I've got a crying jag."
The war touched the Model Press Clipping Bureau with its mailed finger and made it wither away. First, the client who was the backbone of the business, the man who paid out thousands a year for clippings on the Panama Canal and such, came in the day after the declaration of war and said that since his address would be uncertain for a while, he'd call in person each day for his clippings. A few days later, two slow-moving men with heavy feet came in to see the boss. One of them pushed his palm under the boss's nose, and what he saw in that palm made the boss turn pale. He got a thick stack of clippings from the file box of the most important client. The heavy-footed ones looked them over and returned them to the boss, who put them in an envelope and put the envelope in his desk. The two men went into the boss's lavatory, leaving the door ajar. They waited in there all day. At noon they sent an errand boy out for a bag of sandwiches and a carton of coffee, and they ate their lunch in the lavatory. The Panama Canal client came in at 4:30. In slow motion, the boss handed him the fat envelope. Just as the client put it in his inner coat pocket, the heavy ones strolled out of the lavatory. One of them touched the client on the shoulder. He sighed, took the envelope out of his pocket, and surrendered it. The second heavy one touched him on the shoulder. The client clicked his heels together, bowed stiffly, and walked out between the two men. The boss went home with an acute attack of dyspepsia. That evening, Francie told Mama and Neely how a German spy had been caught right in the office. The next day, a brisk-looking man came in with a briefcase. The boss had to answer a lot of questions, and the brisk man wrote down the answers in spaces provided on a printed form. Then came the sad part. The boss had to make out a check for nearly $400, the balance due on the involuntarily canceled account. After the brisk man left, the boss rushed out to borrow money to make the check good. After that, everything went to pieces. The boss was afraid to take in new accounts, no matter how innocent they seemed. The theatrical season was running out, and actor accounts fell off. The deluge of spring-published books, which brought in hundreds of seasonal $5 author clients and dozens of $100 publisher clients, had not been a deluge, but a mere trickle. Houses were holding off important publications until things settled down a bit. Many research workers canceled their accounts in expectation of being called up in the draft. Even if business had been normal, the Bureau couldn't have handled it because the workers began to go. The government, anticipating a man shortage, threw open civil service examinations for women workers in the big 34th Street post office. Many of the readers took and passed the examination and were called to work immediately. The manual workers, the club, left almost in a body to work in war projects plants. They not only tripled their earnings, but they received much praise for their unselfish patriotism. The boss's wife came back to read, and he fired all the remaining readers except Francie. The huge loft echoed with emptiness as the three of them tried to carry on the business alone. Francie and the wife read, filed, and attended to the office work. The boss slashed impotently at newspapers, printed blurry slips, and pasted items askew. In the middle of June, he gave up. He made arrangements for the sale of his office equipment, broke his lease, and settled the matter of refunds to clients very simply by saying, "Let him sue me." Francie phoned the only other clipping bureau she knew of in New York and asked whether they needed a reader. She was told that they never hired new readers. "We treat our readers right," said an argumentative voice, "and never have to make replacements." Francie thought that was very nice, said so, and hung up. She spent her last morning at the bureau marking help wanted ads. She skipped the office jobs knowing she'd have to start as a file clerk again. You didn't stand a chance in an office unless you were a stenographer and typist. Anyhow, she preferred factory work. She liked factory people better, and she liked keeping her mind free while she worked with her hands. But of course Mama wouldn't let her work in a factory again. She found an ad that seemed a happy combination of factory and office. Operating a machine in office surroundings. A communications corporation offered to teach girls teletype machine operating and to pay them $12.50 a week while they were learning. The hours were 5 p.m. to 1 a.m. At least that would give her something to do with her evenings, if she got the job. When she went to say goodbye to the boss, he told her that he'd have to owe her the last week's salary. He had her address, he said, and would send it. Francie said goodbye to the boss, to his wife, and to her final week's pay. The Communications Corporation had a skyscraper office overlooking the East River in downtown New York. Along with a dozen other girls, Francie filled out an application after presenting a fervent letter of recommendation from her ex-boss. She took an aptitude test in which she answered questions which seemed silly. Which weighs the most, a pound of lead or a pound of feathers, was an example. Evidently, she passed the test, for she was given a number, a locker key for which she had to pay a quarter deposit, and told to report the next day at 5 o'clock. It wasn't quite 4 when Francie got home. Katie was cleaning in their house, and she looked upset when she saw Francie come up the stairs. "Don't look so worried, Mama. I'm not sick or anything." "Oh," said Katie, relieved. "For a moment I thought you had lost your job." "I have." "Oh, my!" "And I won't get my last week's pay, either. But I got another job. Start tomorrow. 12.5 a week. I'll get a raise in time, I expect." Katie started to ask questions. "Mama, I'm tired. Mama, I don't want to talk. We'll talk about it tomorrow. And I don't want supper. I just want to go to bed." She went upstairs. Katie sat on the steps and started to worry. Since war started, prices of food and everything else had skyrocketed. In the past month, Katie had not been able to add to Francie's bank account. The $10 a week hadn't been enough. Lori had to have a quart of fresh milk every day, and the milk modifier was expensive. Then there had to be orange juice. Now with $12.50 a week, after Francie's expenses were taken out, there'd be less money. Soon it would be vacation. Neely could work during the summer. But what about the fall? Neely would return to high school. Francie had to get to high school that fall. How? How? She sat there and worried. Francie, after a brief glance at the sleeping baby, undressed and got into bed. She folded her hands under her head and stared at the gray patch, which was the airshaft window. "Here I am," she thought. 15 years old, and a drifter. I've been working less than a year, and I've had 3 jobs already. I used to think it would be fun to go from one job to the other, but now I'm scared. I've been fired from 2 jobs, through no fault of my own. At each job, I worked as best I could. I gave everything I could give. And here I'm starting all over again somewhere else. Only now I'm frightened. This time when the new boss says, jump once, I'll jump twice because I'll be afraid of losing the job. I'm scared because they're depending on me here for money. How did we ever get along before I worked? Well, there wasn't Lori then. Neely and I were smaller and could do with less, and of course, Papa helped some. Well, goodbye college. Goodbye everything, for that matter. She turned her face away from the gray light and closed her eyes. Francie sat at a typewriter in a big room. There was a metal roof fastened over the top of Francie's machine so that she couldn't see the keyboard. An enormous chart of the keyboard diagram was tacked up in front of the room. Francie consulted the chart and felt for the letters under the shield. That was the first day. On the second day, she was given a stack of old telegrams to copy. Her eyes went from the copy to the chart as her fingers groped for the letters. At the end of the second day, she had memorized the position of the letters on the machine and didn't have to consult the chart. A week later, they took the shield off. It made no difference now. Francie was a touch typist. An instructor explained the workings of the teletype machine. For a day, Francie practiced sending and receiving dummy messages. Then she was put on the New York-Cleveland wire. She thought it a wonderful miracle that she could sit at that machine and type and have the words come out hundreds of miles away on a piece of paper on the roller of a machine in Cleveland, Ohio. No less miraculous was that a girl typing away in Cleveland made the hammers of Francie's machine pound out the words. It was easy work. Francie would send for an hour, then receive for an hour. There were 2 15-minute rest periods in the work shift and a half an hour for lunch at 9 o'clock. Her pay had been increased to 15 a week when she went on a wire. All in all, it wasn't a bad job. The household adjusted itself to Francie's new schedule. She left home soon after 4 in the afternoon and got home a little before 2 in the morning. She pressed the bell button 3 times before she entered the hallway so that Mama could be on the alert and make sure that Francie wouldn't be attacked by someone lurking in the hallways. Francie slept mornings until 11 o'clock. Mama didn't have to get up so early because Francie was in the flat with Lori. She started work in her own house first. By the time she was ready for the other 2 houses, Francie was up and looking after Lori. Francie had to work on Sunday nights, but she had Wednesday night off. Francie liked the new arrangement. It took care of her lonely evenings, it helped Mama out, and gave Francie a few hours each day to sit in the park with Lori. The warm sun did both of them a lot of good. A plan took shape in Katie's mind, and she spoke to Francie about it. "Will they keep you on night work?" she asked.
"Will they? They tickle to death.
No girl wants to work nights. That's why they push it off on the new girls. I was thinking that maybe in the fall you could keep on working nights and go to high school in the daytime. I know it'll be hard, but it could be done somehow."
"Mama, no matter what you say, I won't go to high school."
"But you fought to go last year."
"That was last year. That was the right time to go. Now it's too late."
"It's not too late, and don't be stubborn."
"But what in the world could I learn in high school now?"
"Oh, I'm not conceited or anything, but after all, I read 8 hours a day for almost a year, and I learned things. I've got my own ideas about history and government and geography and writing and poetry. I've read too much about people, what they do and how they live. I've read about crimes and about heroic things. Mama, I've read about everything. I couldn't sit still now in a classroom with a bunch of baby kids and listen to an old maid teacher drool away about this and that. I'd be jumping up and correcting her all the time. Or else I'd be good and swallow it all down, and then I'd hate myself for, well, eating mush instead of bread. So I will not go to high school, but I will go to college someday."
"But you've got to go through high school before they'll let you in college."
"4 years of high school? No, 5, because something would come up to delay me. Then 4 years of college, I'd be a dried-up old maid of 25 before I was finished."
"Whether you like it or not, you'll get to be 25 in time, no matter what you do. You might as well be getting educated while you're going towards it."
"Once and for all, Mama, I will not go to high school."
"We'll see," said Katie, as her jaw settled into a square line. Francie said nothing more. But the set of her jaw was like her mother's. However, the conversation gave Francie an idea. If Mama thought she could work evenings and go to high school in the day, why couldn't she go to college that way? She studied a newspaper ad. Brooklyn's oldest and most reputable college was advertising summer courses available for college students wishing to take advanced work or to make up or work off conditions, and for high school students wishing to gain advanced college credits. Francie thought she might come under the last heading. She wasn't exactly a high school student, but she was eligible to be one. She sent for the catalog. From the catalog, she chose 3 courses with classes meeting in the afternoon. She'd be able to sleep as usual until 11, attend classes, and go straight to work from the college. She chose beginning French, elementary chemistry, and something called restoration drama. She figured up the tuition, a little over $60 with laboratory fees. She had $105 in her savings account. She went to Katie.
"Mama, could I have $65 of the money you've been saving for me towards college?"
"What for?"
"College, of course."
She was deliberately casual for the drama of it. She was rewarded by the way Mama's voice scaled up as she repeated after Francie.
"College?"
"Summer school college."
But,
sputtered Katie.
"I know. No high school.
But maybe I can get in if I tell them I don't want a diploma or any grades, that I just want the lessons.
Katie got her green hat down from the closet shelf.
Where you going, Mama?
To the bank for the money. Francie laughed at her mother's eagerness.
It's after hours. The bank's closed. Besides, there's no hurry. Registration's a week off yet.
The college was located in Brooklyn Heights, another strange section of Great Brooklyn for Francie to explore. As she filled out the registration blank, her pen hovered over the question of previous education. There were three headings with blanks after them. Elementary schools, high schools, and colleges. After a little thought, she crossed out the words and wrote in the space above them, "Privately educated."
And when you come right down to it, that's no lie, she assured herself.
To her utter relief and astonishment, she was not challenged in any way. The cashier took her money and gave her a receipt for her tuition. She was given a registration number, a pass to the library, a schedule of her classes, and a list of the textbooks she needed. She followed a crowd to the college bookshop further down the block. She consulted her list and ordered a beginning French and an elementary chemistry.
"New, a second hand?" asked the clerk.
"Why, I don't know. Which am I supposed to have?"
"New," said the clerk.
Someone touched her on the shoulder. She turned and saw a handsome, well-dressed boy. He said, "Get second hand. Serves the same purpose as new, and half the price."
"Thank you," she turned to the clerk.
"Second hand," she said firmly. She started to order the two books for the drama course. Again, the touch on her shoulder.
"Uh-uh," said the boy negatively.
"You can read them in the library before and after classes, and when you get cuts."
"Thank you again," she said.
"Any time," he answered, and sauntered away. Her eyes followed him out of the store.
"Gosh, he's tall and good-looking," she thought.
"College is certainly wonderful." She sat on the L train on her way to the office, clutching the two textbooks. As the train grated over the tracks, its rhythm seemed to be, "College, college, college." Francie started to feel sick. She felt so sick that she had to get off at the next station even though she knew she'd be late for work. She leaned against a penny-weighing machine, wondering what was the matter with her. It couldn't have been anything she ate, because she had forgotten to eat lunch. Then a thunderous thought came to her. "My grandparents never knew how to read or write. Those who came before them couldn't read or write. My mother's sister can't read or write. My parents never even graduated from grade school. I never went to high school. But I, M. Francis K. Nolan, am now in college. Do you hear that, Francie? You're in college." "Oh, gosh, I feel sick."
Francie came away from her first chemistry lecture in a glow. In 1 hour, she had found out that everything was made up of atoms, which were in continual motion. She grasped the idea that nothing was ever lost or destroyed. Even if something was burned up or left to rot away, it did not disappear from the face of the earth. It changed into something else, gases, liquids, and powders. Everything, decided Francie after that first lecture, was vibrant with life, and there was no death in chemistry. She was puzzled as to why learned people didn't adopt chemistry as a religion. The drama of the Restoration, aside from the time-consuming reading required, was easy to manage after her home study of Shakespeare. She had no worries about that course, nor the chemistry course. But when it came to beginning French, she was lost. It wasn't really beginning French. The instructor, working on the knowledge that his students either had taken it before and flunked it, or had already had it in high school, sloughed over the preliminaries and got right down to translation. Francie, shaky enough regarding English grammar, spelling, and punctuation, didn't stand a chance with the French language. She'd never pass the course. All she could do was memorize vocabulary each day and try to hang on. She studied going back and forth on the L. She studied in her rest periods and ate her meals with a book propped up on the table before her. She typed out her assignments on one of the machines in the instruction room of the Communications Corporation. She was never late or absent, and she asked nothing more than to pass at least two of her courses. The boy who had befriended her in the bookstore became her guardian angel. His name was Ben Blake, and he was a most amazing fellow. He was a senior in a Maspeth high school. He was editor of the school magazine, president of his class, played halfback on the football team, and was an honor student. For the past 3 summers, he had been taking college courses. He would finish high school with more than 1 year of college work out of the way. In addition to his schoolwork, he put in his afternoons working for a law firm. He drew up briefs, served summonses, examined deeds and records, and searched out precedents. He was familiar with the state statutes and was completely capable of trying a case in court. Besides doing so well in school, he earned $25 a week. His firm wanted him to come into the office full-time after his graduation from high school, read law with them, and eventually take the bar exam.